This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel's indiscriminate strikes target the maternity ward of a hospital in southern Gaza, causing casualties as the regime's bloody onslaught in the territory continues. Yemen says operations against Israel-linked ships in the Red Sea will stop only when the regime's onslaught on Gaza ends and the territory's siege is lifted. And Pope Francis condemns the killing of two Christian women by Israeli forces, saying the regime uses, quote, terrorism tactics in the Gaza Strip. Hello everyone from the studios in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Day 73 of the Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip, where fresh airstrikes and shelling have killed scores of Palestinian civilians. In the Nusayrat camp in central Gaza, at least 50 people were killed in air raids targeting residential buildings. Israeli bombardment also took the lives of over 30 people in the city of Jabalia in the northern part of the Strip. Several areas of Gaza City have also been struck. As a result, dozens of dead bodies were brought to Al-Shifa Hospital. The southern city of Khan Yunis witnessed fresh attacks too. The regime's artillery shelled the maternity ward of Nasser Hospital, killing a teenage girl and wounding a number of other people. The Palestinian Red Crescent has slammed as extremely dangerous the shelling of the medical facility in Khan Yunis. According to the humanitarian organization, the regime's attacks on Gaza since October the 7th have claimed the lives of 300 medical workers. Israel's indiscriminate bombardment of Gaza has left no safe place for civilians. Now Palestinians in the southern city of Rafah are recounting the challenges they are facing.
We walked to seek assistance from the first aid and civil defense teams, despite facing challenges with poor connectivity, internet issues, and a disrupted communication network. They deliberately cut off these services, preventing anyone from communicating with ambulance crews, civil defense teams, and the media. This area was supposed to be a safe zone, but there is no safety across the entire Gaza Strip.
These buildings have people from Gaza and the north, from all governorates, staying here as it is a safe place, but there is no safety. Israelis hit every place. They target it everywhere. They target at night. Children are always scared and they wake up screaming because of the bombardment sounds. Everywhere in Rafah, there are big targets. Unfortunately, there is no safety.
A senior member of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the group will not enter into a prisoner swap agreement with Israel unless the regime stops its onslaught on Gaza. Khalil Al-Hayya says it would not be sensible to sign a prisoner exchange deal while Palestinians are under fire. He also says Hamas has what it takes to resist for months, adding whoever thinks of a post-Hamas era is in delusion. Al-Hayya has urged Muslim countries to force the Israeli regime into allowing humanitarian aid to enter Gaza. The top Hamas official argued that the entry of 100 trucks with relief aid is not enough at all for besieged Gazans. He says the resistance front will continue to counter the occupiers and inflict further losses on them. Heavy fighting is underway in the Gaza Strip between Israeli forces and Palestinian resistance groups. The Al-Ghassan Brigade says it hit two Israeli military vehicles with rockets. It says the group destroyed an Israeli tank in Deir al-Balah. Palestinian resistance fighters attacked a gathering of Israeli soldiers in Khan Yunis, leaving several soldiers dead and injured. The Al-Quds brigades have also conducted retaliatory operations against Israeli forces. The group says it destroyed an Israeli Merkava tank and hit a gathering of regime soldiers in Shejaya, inflicting heavy losses on them. The regime has so far confirmed the deaths of 121 forces in Gaza. However, Hamas says the casualties amongst Israeli forces are much higher and that the regime is hiding the real number. New footage has been released showing Palestinian health officials holding a news conference in northern Gaza, running for cover as the sound of Israeli gunfire is heard nearby. Munir Al-Bursh, Director General of the Ministry of Health in Gaza, was delivering a statement outside the Kamal Adwan Hospital when the incident happened. Israeli forces raided the hospital on Tuesday after besieging and shelling it for several days. On Saturday, doctors and other witnesses said Israeli forces bulldozed tents housing displaced and injured Palestinians inside the hospital compound and buried them alive. The Council on American Islamic Relations has called for a UN probe into the matter. The Palestinian Health Ministry has also demanded an immediate investigation. The hospital has been under direct siege for 10 days in a row, with reports of Israeli forces shooting at anything in its vicinity. The structure now appears to be almost completely destroyed. Witnesses say Israeli forces attacked patients and doctors at Kamal Adwan Hospital during their raid and arrested medical personnel.
We've been displaced, and today they demolished the building, killing doctors, leaving nothing behind. They haven't even spared the doctors. Look, my son is there under the rubble, and I can't reach him. For God's sake, where are the Arab nations? Don't they see what's being done to us? They've been killing us since 1948. This is not a war.
They have been injured and have been in the hospital for 10 days. As soon as the Israeli troops withdrew, I rushed to take them. As you can see, they suffer from total burns for no reason. They were left with no food or water and no care. There are other injured members of my family, but I wasn't able to carry them. After I arrived at the hospital, I witnessed massive destruction, an indescribable scene. Patients are scattered in every corner, beds are overturned, and medical material are damaged. There are no conditions conducive to sustaining life. I managed to carry them with my own hands to transport them to a safe place.
Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement says the country's armed forces will stop their operations against Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea if the regime puts an end to its aggression against Gaza. Ansarullah spokesman Mohammed Abdul Salam said Israel's blockade of Gaza must be lifted so that the food and medicine can be sent to the Strip. He added that the anti-Israel maritime operations have had a huge impact on the regime's economy. Abdul Salam underlined that Israel poses a threat to all Muslim countries as well as Islamic unity. He added, Yemen's stance on the issue of Palestine has its roots in national, ethical and religious principles. Over the past weeks, the Yemeni army has targeted a number of Israel-bound vessels in waters around the Arab country. The strikes were in response to Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. The head of the Roman Catholic Church has condemned the Israeli killing of two Christian women who had taken refuge in a church in Gaza City. Pope Francis says Tel Aviv is using, quote, terrorism tactics in Gaza, adding unarmed civilians are the targets of Israeli strikes. The pontiff referred to a statement by the Latin Patriarchate of Al-Quds that said a mother and daughter were shot and killed in cold blood as they walked in the compound of the Gaza's only Catholic church. One was killed as she tried to carry the other to safety. According to the statement, seven others were also injured. This is not the first time Israel has conducted attacks on religious sites. Back in October, the Greek Orthodox Church, where hundreds of people were taking shelter, was bombed, leaving at least 18 people, including children, dead. The Israeli army has also targeted many mosques during their onslaught on Gaza. The Israeli Prime Minister is facing harsh criticism at home over the handling of the issue of captives being held by Hamas. Israelis have been piling up pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu since three of those captives were killed by the regime's own forces in Gaza some days ago. One of the three slain captives was buried near Tel Aviv on Sunday. During the funeral, his brother slammed the Israeli military for abandoning and murdering him. The three men were killed near Gaza City by invading Israeli troops on Friday. It sparked protests in Tel Aviv, where people vented their anger at Netanyahu and called on him to initiate negotiations to get captives released. More than 100 Israelis are still being held by Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza. That's after a week-long truce in late November saw Hamas swapping more than 100 captives with 240 Palestinian women and children held in jails. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has issued a statement saying it targeted an Israeli military post where four regime forces were stationed. It comes after Israel carried out shelling inside Lebanon. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh joined us earlier to tell us exactly what happened.
This morning we woke up to the sound of heavy Israeli shelling, which was all around this area. This is the Marjayun area near the Khiyam town and Kfar Killa. Also, the Kfar Shuba Hills, Hezbollah launched two of its operations today. We have Hanita and Birkat Risha that were the Israeli posts that were targeted today at 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. by Hezbollah's resistance. We do have statements on those, but we also know from Israeli media that they heard the siren sounding in the settlement of Sa'asa, and they say that two anti-tank missiles struck the posts of the Israelis and Israeli hideouts in those settlements. They are using, of course, the so-called civilian settlements in order to take to stage, of course, their military presence, the Israeli soldiers, of course. And when you talk about the situation as a whole, we do know that there are daily resistance operations. We cannot really talk about a specific pattern, but what we can say, when it comes to Hezbollah, we know for sure they are hitting precise targets. They are using specific weapons. When they use different weapons that they can declare about, like, for example, the Burkan rocket, that has been used not very openly, not in many times. It seems to have been used by Hezbollah as a precise rocket, which can be hit into areas that are a bit further off from the border, but at the same time, it's not even detected by the Iron Dome or by Israeli other defense systems. Up until now, they have not been able to detect it.
Israeli warplanes have carried out fresh strikes on Syria, targeting the vicinity of the capital, Damascus. According to the Syrian military, the rockets were launched from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights. It added the country's air defenses intercepted and shot down most of the missiles. The offensive, however, left two people wounded and caused some material damage. The Israeli regime frequently targets the war-ravaged Arab country, particularly areas in and around Damascus. The Syrian government has on numerous occasions called on the United Nations to force the Israeli regime to stop its acts of aggression. Damascus says the assaults are in violation of international law and aimed at propping up terrorists. Nasser Kazmi has talked to some medical doctors about the pain and suffering of Palestinians in Gaza. Let's listen to what they had to say about the onslaught in the besieged territory.
The Israel is not allowing any medical aid, any food, and is not letting anyone establish any kind of shelter with them, and it's moving them all. The motives, they are clear, actually, but this is a very unjust. It is against all the principles of the war, all Geneva Conventions and all the rules of the war.
Whatever is happening in Gaza, you know, it's unprecedented. World has never seen such atrocities, such merciless killing of women, children, across the board bombardment, destruction of healthcare facilities, shelters, and murdering of innocent civilians. World has never seen before, not even the world wars, not even the Ukraine war.
With their power, with their might, with their weapons, they can reduce this population. With genocide, they can take all these areas in their control. So actually, this is actually their inbuilt, you know, default is there, that Israel was built in a way that is illegal. So they want to continue their authority with this illegal and war crime.
While there's been no let-up in Israeli atrocities in Gaza, people across the world have also been equally unwavering in their support for Palestinians in the besieged strip. Let's bring you up to date with some of the latest pro-Palestinian rallies. Protesters in France called for a total and permanent ceasefire. They carried banners calling for the right of life of people of Gaza and expressed support for the struggle of Palestinians for freedom. Across the Channel and in the southeastern UK city of Brighton, people also marched in support of Palestinians. The rally was a culmination of 20 local groups all calling for a ceasefire. Meanwhile, in the Canadian capital of Ottawa, protesters waved Palestinian flags and chanted "Free, Free Palestine" at a Zara store. That's because of an ad campaign by the fashion brand featuring statues wrapped in white. Activists say the images resemble photos of corpses in white shrouds in Gaza. Zara withdrew the ad earlier in the week. In a letter to the Swedish Prime Minister, an Iranian female prisoner has thanked the Swedish government for prosecuting and imprisoning an Iranian national following accusations by the terrorist Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization. Narges Mohammadi has been convicted on various charges, including spreading propaganda against the Islamic establishment in Iran. She was awarded the 2023 Nobel Peace Prize in what Tehran has called a political and spiteful move. Farzana Ashourian has more in this report.
Files a lawsuit in a European country against an Iranian civilian. The country arrests the man and keeps him in total isolation on baseless allegations. This is the story of Hamid Nouri, who was illegally imprisoned by the Swedish government in 2019 because of a lawsuit that the terrorist Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization had filed against him. They accused him of involvement in the execution of the members of the group in Iran in the 1980s, an accusation that has not even been proved. Hamid Nouri is called the most isolated prisoner in the history of Sweden, as he has not even been able to meet with his family. In the meantime, Narges Mohammadi, an Iranian woman who has been in and out of prison for committing various crimes against the Iranian nation and the country's Islamic establishment, has sent a letter to the Swedish government while in prison. She has thanked Sweden for putting Nouri on trial.
Sweden is a role model for freedom, democracy, and powerful civil society. Your country hosted one of the biggest symbols of justice for Iran in these years.
Mohammadi, who was awarded the Nobel Prize last week, has been criticized by Nouri's son as she has supported a terrorist group.
Narges Mohammadi is a prisoner in Evin. She has written a letter to the Swedish Prime Minister. Her husband also met with the King of Sweden. She's trying to bolster my father's trial, but she knows well that she's actually helping us with her stupidity, and she's making it clear which is notorious, the Evin prison or Sweden. A stupid enemy is good for these times.
These developments coincide with the trial of MEK members in Tehran for killing more than 17,000 Iranian civilians. The proceedings are aimed at bringing the criminals and those who have supported them to justice. Farzana Ashourian, Tehran.
And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
And the opinion poll has found that almost 70% of American workers thought Joe Biden's economic policies had either hurt the U.S. economy or had no impact, including 33% who said they believed the president's policies had hurt the economy a lot. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Citing data from consumer surveys and analysis on food insecurity and grocery shopping behavior, the website Axios reported food banks have found themselves amid a rock and a hard place as donations are plummeting amid surging demand. Divert Inc., an impact technology company, has found that inflation and mounting grocery prices are preventing Americans from making donations during the holiday season. The company's report says only 25% of respondents said they are more likely to donate during this year's holiday season compared to years past. Those who are donating less to food banks this season cite increasing food and grocery costs as the number one reason driving their decision. The technology company also revealed that the current economic climate in the United States prompted 72% of the American public to change their grocery shopping habits. 51% of respondents said grocery prices are forcing them to cut costs in other areas. What's more, 25% of consumers expressed anxiety about their ability to afford food in the next 3 to 6 months. 30% said they're now buying less fresh food like produce as prices bite. According to Divert, 85% of respondents believe that food insecurity countrywide has surged since the COVID-19 pandemic. Furthermore, 63% suggested that the United States is far more food insecure than the latest United States Department of Agriculture data indicates. According to the United States Department of Agriculture data, food insecurity started climbing in 2022 for the first time in more than a decade, with 44 million Americans living in food insecure households last year, which constitutes a 31% increase since 2021. Out of this number, 13 million American children were food insecure in 2022, a 44% spike since last year. For its part, Feeding America, a network of 200 food banks, cites surging demand for food assistance across the United States. A network of 47 food pantries in Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, has registered a 50% increase in visits. Morgan's food banks in Oregon have also seen a 50% surge in demand this year. A survey by Parents Together Action, a non-profit family advocacy organization, shows that 7 in 10 lower- and middle-income parents are struggling to afford food ahead of Thanksgiving. According to mainstream U.S. media, it's the first holiday season where people in need are enduring growing pressure within the federal government's pandemic-era food assistance, which was halted last March. Sputnik News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Minutes from the Federal Reserve's latest policy meeting on Tuesday, 21st of November, U.S. inflation remains unacceptably high after nearly 2 years of monetary tightening. Referring to its Federal Open Market Committee, the U.S. Federal Reserve said the participants in the meeting stressed that current inflation remained unacceptably high while claiming that it had moderated somewhat over the past year. The U.S. Central Bank also suggested it could resume monetary tightening after holding rates unchanged in 3 straight meetings of the Federal Open Market Committee in July, September, and November. While Wall Street is clamoring for interest rate cuts to begin in 2024, the U.S. Federal Reserve did not address that matter. However, the Federal Reserve claimed the economic data showing a significant retreat in inflationary pressure would be all important for it to change course on interest rates. The meeting from the Federal Open Market Committee said all participants judged that it would be appropriate for policy to remain at a restrictive stance for some time until inflation is clearly moving down sustainably towards the committee's objective. Participants stressed the need to see more data indicating inflationary pressures were abating to be more confident of price increases returning to 2%. Inflation measured by the so-called Consumer Price Index, or CPI, hit a 4-decade high of 9.1% during the year to June of 2022. By October of this year, though, the Consumer Price Index had moderated to just 3.2%. Yet, that number remains well beyond the central bank's 2% per year inflation target. The minutes added, participants continue to view a period of below-trend growth in real gross domestic product and some softening in labor market conditions as likely to be needed to bring aggregate demand and aggregate supply into better balance and reduce inflationary pressures sufficiently to return inflation to the 2% level. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. In the latest sign that the US president's economic record could undermine his re-election prospects, only 14% of the American voters believe they're better off financially now than they were when Joe Biden took office. A new opinion poll found that almost 70% of voters thought that Joe Biden's economic policies have either hurt the US economy or had no impact on it, including 33% who said they believe the president's policies had hurt the economy a lot. Only 26% said his policies had helped the economy. The new monthly opinion poll conducted for the Financial Times and the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business will seek to track how economic sentiment affects the race for the White House. In 1980, Republican Ronald Reagan famously asked voters whether they were better off than they were 4 years earlier, setting the stage for his landslide victory over incumbent Democrat Jimmy Carter. A similar opinion poll conducted for the Financial Times 4 years ago showed that most Americans felt they had not improved their financial position under then-President Donald Trump, but their pessimism was far less pronounced. In November of 2019, only 35% of voters believed they were better off under Donald Trump, while 31% said they were worse off. The new opinion poll results showed that inflation continues to cloud the Biden campaign's efforts to convince voters of Bidenomics, the president's strategy to rejuvenate the country's industrial sector and reverse years of middle-class wage stagnation.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. Welcome back to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Viewpoint. I am Beaton. Once again, I have the honor to be the host of today's episode. And here with me, there are two dear guest speakers, Sheikh Rouhani and Brother Ali, with me here. Welcome to the studio, brothers.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure for us to be here.
We are the inheritors of God's prophets, and we are the obvious reason of God, and we are the means by which God connects with creation, and we are the ones accepted, liked, and chosen by God, and are in the position of pure things, and our Shia are from the best people in heaven. These are the words of the most outstanding lady in an example of compassion, generosity, and enduring sufferings and pain of all time throughout history, which is Hazrat Fatima, peace be upon her. And today we're going to talk more about the lifestyle, about the actually guidance of this lady for all of the females around the world and not only Muslim community. So, Sheikh Rouhani, could you please tell us an introduction towards the topic of today's episode?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, as you rightly mentioned, when it comes to the Lady Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, the daughter of the Holy Prophet, salatullahi alayhi, some of the characteristics of this lady are very much meaningful and very much instructive for not only the ladies and the women, but also for all the people, men and women. To mention some of these characteristics, one of the things that we see in the life of Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha is this, that she was so much active lady, politically active, socially active, morally active, religiously active, even economically active. So such an active lady in the beginning of Islam, at the early years of Islam, can be very much interesting and also unbelievable, because women and ladies at the time of the advent of Islam in the those qabail or tribal kind of, let's say, environment in Arab Peninsula, unfortunately, the way that the people dealt with the women or treat the women was not a kind of humanistic or humanitarian way, because they looked upon the women like something very much similar to like animals, because they were always fighting each other, killing, murdering, always there were battles. And in that kind of environment, of course, ladies could not do that much for their tribe, for their families. And unfortunately, and also there were no farm to work. Even the ladies couldn't work in those kind of, let's say, farms, for example. So that's why women had no value in the eyes of these people. When Islam came, Islam actually introduced some ladies, particularly Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha, as the role model for not only the women and ladies at the time of Islam, but also for the whole history. So that's why when we look at this lady who was brought up by the Holy Prophet ﷺ in the house of the Holy Prophet, we see such an active lady, such a knowledgeable lady, such a righteous, such a mu'min, believer lady, such a lady who sacrificed a lot for the sake of Islam, for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, a lady who was submitted completely to the commandments and orders of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, a lady who actually defined the whole life of her, the haqiqah or the truth of Islam, and the lady who brought up the best, let's say, children, like Abu Abdullah al-Hussein and, let's say, Imam al-Hasan alayhim as-salatu was-salam. the lady who lived with the best of the creature, we can say, which is who was Amirul Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wassalam. This lady who is the mother of A'imma, Ummul A'imma, all the offspring of this lady are among them are the Ahlul Bayt, the A'imma alayhim salatu wassalam, and she is the link between Wahi and Imama, between Risala and Imama. So all these kind of characteristics when we see in this lady, it introduces this lady as a real role model for all of us, particularly for women. So that is why when we talk of the characteristics of this lady, we should focus on these aspects of the lady's life, particularly from social perspective, moral perspective, religious perspective, even from a scholarly perspective, as Lady Salamullahi Alayha presented speeches, lectures among the people. When we look at these sermons and the speeches presented by Lady, we see how much knowledgeable figure she was. And at the same time, when we see the bravery, the courageous of this lady, we see that she was the most, let's say, courage and brave lady who stood up against the oppression, against the oppressors, who actually defended Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam in the most bravest kind of way. All of these things that when we see, and also at the same time, he sacrificed for the sake of Islam many things, including herself, we can say, because it is clear that defending and protecting wilaya and guardianship caused her a lot of pain, a lot of, let's say, problems. As a result of those pains, she died and she was martyred. So all these sacrifices she made, all the activities she actually had for Islam, all the, let's say, efforts that she made for the sake of Islam, all of these things can be discussed, and they are really bright kind of sides of the Lady Zahra Salamullah Alayha's life and personality that could be discussed.
Thank you, Sheikh Rouhani, for counting all the aspects of the life of our Lady Fatima, peace be upon her. And for sure, there are a lot to learn from this respectful lady. And you mentioned one important hint, actually, that Lady Fatima, peace be upon her, was actually a symbol for the female freedom. And at that time, it was a miracle for a woman to stand there, to talk to people, to teach them, to actually take part in society. And I think which is really related to the conversations and controversies that we have at the moment about the right of women and so many other things. And another actually important aspect of the lifestyle of Lady Fatima, peace be upon her, was about the motherhood of this lady, which at the same time she was participating in the society, she was a mother, a complete mother and a role model. And Brother Ali, I wanted you to elaborate more about the balance between these two aspects of life of a woman, and specifically Lady Fatima, peace be upon her, as a role model for all the females around the world.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Yes, if we want to look at this great lady of Islam as a role model from the viewpoint of her being as a mother, I think this is only one aspect of her miraculous life, that she was a role model in different aspects. Even in the statements of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, we see that while he wants to elaborate and promote the idea of Islamic lifestyle and the framework of a happy life, or let's say Hayatun Tayyiba, he refers to the life of Lady Fatima Salamullah Alayha, and he says this is a lady that we have to study again, and we have to learn a lot from her, and we should appoint her as our role model. Yes, at the same time that she was a role model for
The ladies of the world, Sayyidatun Nisa'al Alameen, that is, that she is the leader of the ladies of the world, the leader of the ladies of both worlds. At the same time, she could be a role model also for men as well, not only for the ladies, because based on a hadith that was narrated by one of the wives of the Holy Prophet that said she was the most similar person to the Holy Prophet. So if we are after learning from the Holy Prophet, the Sunnah of the Prophet, the moralities, ethics of the ethical values of the Holy Prophet, so we need to look at her as a man, or as a woman, it doesn't matter. But with regard to your specific aspect and feature of Lady Fatima sallallahu alayha as a mother of Hassanain and Zainabain, mother of some boys and girls, we need to know how she tackled with this issue. What kind of concerns did she have in the upbringing of her kids? You know that she almost had this period of having all these three or four kids within a period of less than 10 years. But we see how, based on the narrations that we receive, though narrations are a bit silent about different aspects of life, but at least to the extent that we have received, you know how beautiful she raises her children. She teaches her children to be caring for the neighbors first rather than for herself or themselves. While Imam Hassan alayhi salam finds her mother, that she prays for the neighbors first, and she prioritizes the neighbors on her and her family. Moreover, in the kind of, let's say, Islamic upbringing that she cares for her children, we have seen in narrations that Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while he was memorizing the Holy Quran, he came to the Lady Fatima and actually presented his memorization to his mother, and she was listening, correcting, and giving advices on how she and how he needs to learn the Quran, and also the way that we have heard and read that, and we have heard and read that she was preparing her children to stand awake in the night of Qadr. So it means it was very important for her to have, while they were very young, the children were very young, she actually accustomed them and she made it a habit for them to stand awake at the night of Qadr. So it means she did care for the upbringing of her children in the best way possible, and as she was a good daughter for her father as well, and even she was called Umma Abiha, that is mother of her father, that is after the time that the Lady Khadija sallallahu alaiha passed away, she played the role of a mother even for her father. So she was really, and she is a really good model, role model for all our ladies and sisters to take lessons from her in the upbringing of their children.
Thank you, Brother Ali. So you mentioned something about the relationship between Lady Fatima and her father, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family. And dear listeners, these actually topics and these episodes are just only triggers for you in order to go seek knowledge and find the right way to live. So thank you for listening to us. It was all the time we had for today's episode. So I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
You came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been.
so close, everyone will say, please save me, except Al-Habib. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها لنا يوم القيامة. أمتي أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The United Nations has warned that world leaders have to stop doodling and start doing when it comes to carbon emission cuts. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website yahoo.com has covered this story and tells us more. Global climate investment needs to rise to $3.6 trillion by 2026, Alliance Trade has said ahead of the COP28 Environmental Summit this week. The fortnight-long conference will begin on Thursday, 30th of November in Dubai, hosted by the United Arab Emirates, with scores of world leaders and delegates from almost 200 nations set to attend the summit. It's said to be the biggest annual climate congress held under the 1995 United Nations Convention on Climate Change, with British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak set to arrive in the Middle East on Friday, 1st of December. However, there are warnings that the world has made alarming slow progress to achieve the Paris Climate Accord, a legally binding treaty aiming to keep temperature rises well below 2 degrees Celsius. Credit insurer Alliance Trade says investment worldwide needs to hit $3.6 trillion in just 2 years and reach $4.4 trillion by 2046, as they called the next 10 years the decisive decade. Analysts are saying this implies a staggering investment need of approximately $5,000 per ton of annual carbon dioxide emissions, without applying any discount and disregarding impacts on operational costs while assuming a social cost of carbon at $200 per ton of carbon dioxide, this level of investment would become financially viable after 25 years. It comes after the United Nations top climate official Simon Steele warned that world leaders have to stop doodling and start doing when it comes to carbon emission cuts. Simon Steele told The Guardian, "We're now at a point where we are all on the front line, yet most governments are still strolling when they need to be sprinting." The COP28 will focus on energy transition, climate finance, adaptation and resilience, and inclusivity, with a goal of tripling global renewable energy capacity by 2030. Decarbonisation, capture and storage, and cutting methane emissions are crucial targets, while getting the Loss and Damage Fund, established at COP27 summit with a promise of wealthy nations providing $100 billion a year to poorer countries, is a key climate finance priority. The COP28 summit marks the conclusion of the first global stocktake, which evaluated progress on the 2015 Paris Climate Change Agreement. But net zero emissions is no longer even a viable goal, Alliance analysis found, with the window of opportunity to hit 1.5 degrees Celsius target via mitigation having already closed. A briefing by Ludovic Subran, chief economist, stated, "The global economy has made alarmingly slow progress towards achieving the promises of the Paris Climate Accord. The global economy would need to cut carbon emissions nearly by -13% every year from 2025 to 2033. The coronavirus pandemic in 2020 only managed to reduce carbon emissions by -7%. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. World leaders must stop doodling and start doing on carbon emission cuts, as rapidly rising temperatures this year have put everyone on the front line of disaster, the United Nations top climate official Simon Steele has warned. Simon Steele added, "No country could think of itself as immune from catastrophe." Steele will oversee the crucial COP28 climate summit that begins next week in Dubai. Scores of world leaders will arrive in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, for 10 talks on how to tackle the crisis. "We're used to talking about protecting people on the far-flung front lines. We're now at the point where we're all on the front line." Simon Steele added, "We're used to talking about protecting people on the far-flung front lines, but we're now at the point where all of us are on the front line." He added, "Yet most governments are still strolling when they need to be sprinting. Global temperatures have broken new records in recent months, making this year the hottest year on record, and perilously close to the threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels that countries have agreed to hold on to. Temperatures are now heading for a hellish 3 degrees Celsius increase unless urgent and drastic action is taken, but greenhouse gas emissions have continued to rise." Simon Steele said it was still possible to cut greenhouse gas emissions enough to stay within the crucial limit, but that further delay would be dangerous. "Every year of the baby steps we've been taking up to this point means that we need to be taking much bigger leaps with each following year if we are to stay in this race. The science is absolutely clear about this." The fortnight-long COP28 summit will start this Thursday, 30th of November, in Dubai, hosted by the United Arab Emirates, a major oil and gas-producing country. Scores of world leaders, senior ministers and officials from 198 countries will be in attendance, along with an estimated 70,000 delegates, making it the biggest annual conference of the COP summit held under the 1992 United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is expected to attend the summit, and also the British monarch King Charles III will give the opening speech, along with the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, and the President of the United Arab Emirates, Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. The leader of the world's Catholics, the Pope, will also attend the summit, as well as the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Many world leaders from 198 countries will also attend the summit in Dubai. The presidents of the world's two biggest greenhouse gas emitters, Joe Biden of the United States and Xi Jinping of China, are not expected to attend the COP28 summit. But their envoys, John Kerry and Xi Jinhua, have signaled their close cooperation before the talks begin. Sultan Al Jaber, the chief of the United Arab Emirates national oil company ADNOC, will preside over the COP28 summit. Sultan Al Jaber has come under fierce criticism from green campaigners for his dual role, but Simon Steele claimed this was a distraction. Simon Steele said, "This is not the first COP summit to be hosted by a fossil fuel producing nation, and it certainly won't be the last. Every country, even those that are major oil producers, have their role to play," he said. "But what is important are the messages and the signals that the incoming president is giving, and they speak of the need for urgent action and a focus on the how. How do we speed up the transition to a new decarbonized world?" Fossil fuel executives are likely to be out in force at the summit, as they have been an increasing presence at COP summits in recent years. Simon Steele added, "It's important that we recognize that the fossil fuel industry has to be part of the solution. We know where the problem is, but in order to progress the conversation from what needs to be done to how it needs to be done, the fossil fuel industry has to be part of the conversation." However, Simon Steele insisted these companies had to show that they were serious about shifting the world to a zero-carbon economy. Steele said, "Their engagement in the process has to be legitimate, has to be speaking to the necessary actions that are taking the transition away from our current dependence on fossil fuels to a new decarbonized business model." One key issue at the COP28 summit will be the provision of finance for the rescue and rehabilitation of the poorest and most vulnerable communities in the world. The absence of this loss and damage funding has been a long-standing grievance for developing countries, but earlier this month, countries agreed to a blueprint for the fund.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.